Larry Lovins is our guest. Bill Russell and I are here with him in Snowmass, Colorado at Rocky Mountain Institute. Know thee in front of Rocky Mountain Institute. Bill Russell?
And at the end of Natural Capitalism, you do a nice little organizational structure of the political views of the world at large. You break it into four pieces. Paula mentioned colors earlier. You have the blues, you have the reds, you have the greens, and you have the whites. And my sense is that you categorize yourself in that latter category. But I think it might be helpful if you will just do a quick layout of those. Let me do my version of it.
And see how you do.
And you correct me. The greens are, of course, what we have come to think of as greens, who are environmentalists and tend to see the world in those terms. The reds are the old-line socialists who think the government should have a great deal of control. The blues are the capitalists, the people who think that everything is great as it's going and that we should just do more of the same and everything's going to be fine. And the whites you categorize as people, I think this is correct, as people who think that there is some truth in each of those positions, but that none of those positions are complete. And my sense is that your mission that you have chosen to take on is to try to complete those perspectives, and in some way just to bring them together so that instead of fighting with one another and arguing with one another, we actually start working together.
Well, and as the physics of light bring many colors together to be one color, which is white, that you find some commonality with all of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this actually is a formulation due to the late Dana Meadows. She was a wonderful systems analyst, writer, thinker, and she viewed whites as the synthesists who reject ideologies and seek a middle way of integration, reform, respect, reliance. And in a way, they're Jeffersonians. They think that informed citizens can solve most of their own problems. So they take economics seriously rather than literally. They have social concerns and believe in social justice. They try to understand how the world works, which is biological, and try to teach to treat nature as model and mentor and measure, not as some nuisance to be evaded or asset to be liquidated.
That also takes us out of the right-left, conservative-liberal kind of...
Oh, yeah, that's been obsolete for quite a while.
It's been obsolete, but it hasn't gone away in the popular culture, oddly enough.
Well, and that's in that same chapter, at the end of the book, you talk about the dangers of the media, the way we present things, the conflict, the sound bites, the failure to actually go inside to do a reasonable analysis of what's really going on.
Well, you know, we just had an interesting exercise. Rocky Mountain Institute, jointly with another nonpartisan nonprofit called Consensus Building Institute, where we tried to reframe U.S. energy policy in something called the National Energy Policy Initiative, which is all on the web at nepinitiative.org.
Make no small plans.
Yeah. And you know, about a year and a half ago, we saw a train wreck pretty likely in the Senate, and we didn't want this to be the sort of train wreck a bit like the Clinton health care plan, where a bad process yields an outcome that leaves everybody so mad and frustrated they don't want to think about it for a few more years, but the problem is still there and not been dealt with. Well, we've just nationally done the same thing in energy legislation. For next time, I think our template is a little different. We said, let's start by looking for what most Americans agree about, because then the stuff they don't agree about will become less necessary and less important. And why don't we try agreeing first about principles and objectives, and then a lot of the wish list people bring with them will fall off the table as not conforming to the principles and objectives they already agreed to. So we did that. We first interviewed 75 very diverse constituency leaders, found out what they wanted and why they wanted it, what were the underlying value and belief systems, then convened 22 senior energy policy experts who spent the last 30 years figuring out what works and why, And they came up with a very strong consensus on vision, goals, strategies, and largely consensus as well on what kinds of innovative win-win policy instruments would deserve attention. And by now we've gotten 33 distinguished endorsers of this report. It's short and sweet. It's highly integrative. Often we couldn't figure out in which of the four themes to put a given kind of policy direction because it supported all of them. That is, transport and mobility, electricity, services, energy security, and climate protection. And together, what we suggested could meet the nation's economic security and environmental needs simultaneously and without compromise. So it was endorsed by some pretty heavy hitters, half of them current or recent senior executives in the energy industries, and the other half with very distinguished public service records. And I think that ought to get some attention in a fractured Congress and polity by saying, well, next time we come back to this topic, which is going to have to be soon, let's get the process right, then we'll have a better outcome.
I'd like to drop down a level because that is, I mean, obviously energy is a major consideration in the world at large and certainly in the United States. I'm interested in how people whom we assume to be on radically opposite sides who will never agree about anything, what they actually agreed on.
Well, you'll have to read the report, but
the short course.
Well, actually, the most passionate statements in the meeting, particularly from a moral perspective, were coming from the political conservatives in the group. And they were talking about exactly the same outcomes that the political liberals in the group wanted. Perhaps not always for the same reason, but often when they really got down to it, they really wanted the same things. And if you try notions like, well, all technology should get to compete fairly at honest prices, regardless of how big they are or what kind they are or who owns them, that's a pretty simple idea that a lot of people could get behind.
But it has radical implications.
Or let's do the cheapest things first, or let's reward what we want, not the opposite. My own pet peeve on this is that in about 48 states and in most other countries, the companies that distribute our electricity and natural gas get rewarded for selling us more energy and penalized for cutting our bills.
What's wrong with this picture?
So guess what they do? They sell us more energy, and they aren't terribly interested in helping us use the stuff more efficiently and cut our bills. Or why do we pay architects and engineers for what they spend, not what they save? This doesn't make any sense. There are plenty of technical solutions for problems like energy, and the most obvious is, and typically the cheapest and fastest, is to use energy more productively so we wring more work out of it and get the same or better services. I'm talking to you, for example, from in a building where we grow bananas with no heating system at temperatures below minus 40.
This will be Colorado.
Yeah, these are Rocky Mountain high-altitude bananas. And it's cheaper to build that way because the stuff you use to get rid of the heating system, like super insulation and super windows, cost less to put in than the heating system would have cost to put in. And then you save all its running costs as well. So we then reinvested the save money plus a little more to save 99% of the water heating energy, 90% of the household electricity. That would be a $5 a month bill if we bought it all instead of making more than that with solar and selling it back. And the whole thing paid for itself in 10 months. That was 1983 technology. And we've done the same trick in hot climates up to 115F, 46C. Again, better comfort, lower cost. There's a huge amount of efficiency still to be bought, even though it's already the biggest energy source in the United States, providing 2/5 of our energy services.
The notion that you can build buildings. We did a show several years ago with David Orr at Oberlin in his science center.
He cut the roof beams over your head, he and his brother Will.
Well, that's...
Those big oak beams.
Those are twice good oak beams.
Thank you, David.
It was just a revolutionary notion at the time, of which you were a part, and the Rocky Mountain Institute, no, the... also played an important part in thinking about how you went about that. I think what struck me most at the time was the thinking part. The building is great. The building is wonderful. But the thinking part was just revolutionary.
Yeah, in a way, it's not rocket science. It's Victorian whole system engineering rediscovered, where you get multiple benefits from single expenditures. The arch, for example... holding up the middle of this building does 12 different things, but we only pay for it once. There are 5 different kinds of energy collection going on in the greenhouse. That is, we're collecting heat, light, hot air, hot water, and photosynthesis. And the whole thing is like that. It's design integration and optimizing the building as a system. Now, if you were to ask an engineer how much insulation should you have in a cold place, you'd be told, well, just the amount that will pay for itself over the years from the saved heating fuel. But that leaves out the capital cost of the heating system, things like furnace, ducts, fans, pipes, pumps, wires, controls, fuel source. All that costs something to put in, and it turns out you save more than that right up front by not putting it in and making the building very heat tight instead. Well, that's not a very complicated idea, but practically all the engineering books get it wrong. So we need to change both the pedagogy and the practice. So I'm of how we design stuff, and I'm dedicated to the nonviolent overthrow of bad engineering.
This is Amory Lovins. Bill Russell will pick up when we come back in just a moment at Rocky Mountain Institute here in Snowmass, Colorado. We hope you'll be with us when we return.